you to the organizers for putting this all together and scrambling. I also want to thank both the AV and IT staffs, both here and at MSRI, for all of the work that you guys have been doing to make this thing happen under such short notice. The talk I'm going to tell you guys about is, as Chris said, it's called Gap Condensation in Higher Categories. And I want to make a few disclaimers before I begin. Disclaimer one is that we put out our paper, and somehow in the last year or two, also Clausen and Schulze have been using the word condensation or condensed mathematics in, as far as I can tell, a completely different meaning. So if you came to hear about their notion of condensed mathematics, that's not what I'm going to talk about. I just lost a video feed. I'm going to keep going. OK. So the second disclaimer is that the construction I want to tell you about is a sort of higher categorical version of an idempotent completion that we call a condensation completion. Essentially the same, not quite the same, but a very similar construction was studied by Carcaville, Runkel, and Schaumann, and separately by Scott Morrison and Kevin Walker, who are in the audience. And also, but I think we sort of found the right universal property to explain that construction. And the other, and also in the case of two categories, our construction is pretty much the same as work by Chris Douglas and David Reuter, who are also in the audience. The third disclaimer I want to make is that I'm going to work model independently with n categories, which is, of course, a risk, because we don't quite have a firm enough control over certain aspects of the theory of n categories. I think almost everything I say will compile easily in any model, but the one or two theorems at the very end are not quite theorems, because they require a little bit more about weighted colimits in infinity one categories than I think the literature can support. So I say that as an invitation for the people in the audience who are coming from the higher categories workshop, especially, to continue to develop the technical machinery to make this type of model independent work really run really smoothly. So with those disclaimers said, the way I'm going to do my talk is I'm going to give the talk twice. The first half of the talk is going to be basically material from the previous century, known material about one categories. Because it's good, and then I'll build on it, and so that in case anybody in the audience doesn't know it, they know it. But I think everybody in the audience will know the material I'm going to say in the first half of the talk under some name. And then I'll repeat the talk a second time, but with all the one categories replaced by n categories. So as I said, the goal for my talk is to tell you about idempotent or Kurubi completion. And this word condensation, it, for us, is basically the same as some sort of idempotent. That's how you should understand condensation. So the most basic definition in the study of idempotent completion is the following. Is the notion of a split surjection. And this is also goes under many names. It's also called, for instance, a retract. And a split surjection in a one category, in a one category C of X onto Y, is the following data. It's the data of an object X in the category, an object Y in the category, a morphism that I'm going to call F from X onto Y, a morphism that I'm going to call g from y onto x. And it satisfies one property, which is that if you start at y and go up to x and then back to y, you end up with the identity on y. This is a notion that's come up many times. It is a very unfortunate thing that this notion is prevalent throughout all of algebra and topology. And it doesn't have a consensus notation for it yet. So I want to advocate the following notation. I think that this should be called writing x condensing onto y with a little hook, because it looks like an arrow, and it has this, the injection the other way. But you know, take it or leave it with the notation. If you like this symbol, I'll give you the tech code to produce it. So this is the most basic notion of a split surjection. And the really important part of this is that if you have a split surjection like this, then you can study the other composition, and you can study the composition, which is to start at x and go down and then back up. And this composition satisfies a simple equation. It satisfies that it's an idempotent. It squares to itself. And the first theorem you prove in the subject, the sort of most basic theorem, as I said, this is all work from the last century, from before I was born, is that the data of x together with this idempotent e that data determines the rest of the condensation uniquely, if the rest of the condensation exists. Another way to say this is that you can start with an idempotent and ask, what is the category of all ways that the idempotent can factor through an object such that the other composition is the identity? That category is either empty, in which case the idempotent doesn't split, or that category is contractible. So by uniquely, of course, I mean up to unique isomorphism. So that I don't get too far away, let me give an example. I'm working at a physics institute, so I'm going to give a baby physics example. As an example, we could consider a vector space, say a finite dimensional vector space. We could take x to be finite dimensional vector space Cn, which is to say 0 plus 1 dimensional topological quantum field theory. This is a TFT's workshop, after all. And we could equip it with a finite group of symmetries. And given this data, you can build an idempotent, which is a normalized norm element for this action. This is an endomorphism of X. It's a matrix, an n by n matrix. And it's easy to check that it's idempotent. And the image of this idempotent, the splitting, is the, this is an idempotent, this projects the TFTX onto, it projects it onto the fixed points of the group action, which has a physical meaning as the gauged theory. The result of gauging. The G symmetry. So that's all well and good. The point of the story I want to tell you about is not just the fact that you can project out idempotents, but if you have a category C, so the main question you could ask now is the following. So suppose you're given some category. It may not have the property that every idempotent splits. Not all idempotents. Extend to split surjections. But there's a universal way that's quite well known to complete the category, to having all extensions, to having all idempotents split. So the Caribbe completion is a universal completion. So what I want to do is I want to build a category that contains C and has all idempotents split. And so what you do is you build the Caribbe completion is built as follows. I'll give a recipe for it. And the recipe is quite straightforward. The objects of the Caribbe completion are the idempotents in the original category, that's an object together with a morphism, and the idea is that this object, this diagram in C, this is some diagram in C, which I want to act like the splitting of E. So I still have to arrange the morphisms with that property. But the way I do that is I can declare the morphisms, and now I have to worry about the fact that composition runs the wrong direction. So the morphisms from X with idempotent E to X prime with idempotent E prime is going to be all the morphisms from X to X prime such that if you do E and then M, that's the same as doing M. And that should also be the same as doing M and then E prime. So this is a very famous construction, and it satisfies some very famous properties. Namely, so the main facts, and this is maybe what Caribbe proved. I have to actually admit, I never really read what Caribbe did. But the main facts of this are, as I said, it's before I was born, so everybody knows it. Classical means like before you started working. It's a very, the notion of classical mathematics is a sort of very relative thing, depending on the speaker. The main facts, first of all, the objects and morphisms I gave you do, in fact, compile to a category. The second fact is that there's an embedding of C into the Caribbe completion of C. It's fully faithful. This sends an object to the idempotent called the identity. The next fact that you prove when you're doing a first course in category theory and learning about Caribbe completion is that sure enough, the Caribbe completion of C has all idempotents split in the Caribbe completion split. This is a non-trivial statement. To construct the Caribbe completion of C, I declared objects which would be the splittings of the idempotents that were just in C. And now I'm telling you that not only the idempotents that came from C, but also any new idempotents you might have produced in the construction also split. Yes, OK, I have to unmute this so I can hear Chris. Now I can hear you. Oh.
Maybe you could say a couple words about that.
Yes, so let me not mute my microphone and let me mute this. So the question was just the backwards written hom. I want to be able to write composition in the order that it's written. I just mean the morphisms from, this was just a joke, of course. This is, you know, I want to write an arrow from x to y because I would like to remember that, you know, when you compose from right to left. But when we write from left to right. And I just mean the maps from x with idempotent e to x prime with idempotent e prime in the composition direction. May I continue? Okay. So there's two more basic facts, which are that the Kurobe completion of C is universal. It's the universal category for these properties. So it's the universal category which contains C, and you don't even have to say that it's fully faithful. But it's the universal category which receives a map from C and has all idempotents split. And finally, there's an even stronger statement, an even stronger completion. Here I just said that it contained all idempotents, but actually all have what are called absolute limits in car C. Let me say it this way. The Kurobe completion of C contains all absolute limits. Let me say a little bit about what an absolute limit is. So an absolute limit, I won't give a completely precise definition of absolute limit, but the basic idea of an absolute limit is that an absolute limit is a limit which can be checked with an equation. Normally, when you're in a category and you take a limit, to tell that something is a limit of some diagram is an infinitary process. The property of being a limit is something about testing against every other object in your category, which a priori is quite a lot of testing you might have to do. What I'm saying here is that I just have to check an equation, which is to say it's finitely much work to test if I have an absolute limit. And the most basic thing here is these splittings of idempotents themselves. So the idempotent, the object y, I said in the very beginning of my talk that the idempotent x and e determines the object y together with the projection and inclusion maps. And it determines it in lots of ways. It determines it as the only object satisfying this equation, but it also determines it as y is the limit of the diagram x with an idempotent e. And incidentally, it also determines it as the colimit. And another basic working kind of good rule of thumb is that typically when you have something which is both a limit and a colimit, then it's actually an absolute limit. And I just want to remark that the notion of absolute limits is something that's interesting to study in lots of enriched environments. And in particular, we could be working in an additive world, in a linear world, maybe a vect-enriched world, direct sums are also absolute. And when I'm in an enriched world, I actually want to sneak direct sums into my definition. So I have to add them by hand. Maybe I won't write that because I've run out of space. And I'm worried if I write too small, you guys won't be able to see it. So maybe I'll just say it should be added by hand. So in the additive world, the correct way, yes?
Can we tell how a priori whether a limit is absolute or not?
Can one, the question is, can one tell a priori whether a limit is absolute or not? So the, as I said, I wasn't giving a complete definition of absolute. The notion of absolute limit that I want to take is the following. I want to say that being an absolute limit is a property of the shape of the diagram that it's a limit of. And the actual definition is that a diagram presents an absolute limit exactly when limits of diagrams of that shape are preserved by all functors. Now, the question of which diagrams are present absolute limits is an interesting one, and it depends on what ambient kind of world, it depends on what world you're enriched over. So in the worlds of bare categories, the facts about Kurobe completion I listed tell you that basically the only absolute limits are the splittings of idempotents and things you can kind of build out of those. And in the additive world, the only absolute limits are things you can build out of splittings of idempotents and taking direct sums. But there's a fascinating and beautiful story you can ask that, that in particular Laver studied in quite a lot of detail about in other enriching environments what the absolute limits are. And there are environments where we don't have a complete description. Like, you know, you can write down, you might have some favorite worlds of enriched categories, and you might not know which limits are absolute or not. It might be a theorem to decide that this limit is absolute or that limit is absolute. So the last thing I want to say is why this is important. And that's the following main example. So suppose I have a ring or an algebra. I'm going to work now in the additive world. So let's say that R is a ring. And then I can build from R the one object. I can build a category. This is the one object delooping. Now this is the category with one object. And endomorphisms just R itself. Now, as I said, I want to work in the additive world, so I want to include some direct sums. So I can build the what's called the matrix category on this category. So this is where you include direct sums. By construction, this matrix category, by construction, this category with one object is the category whose, you could think of this as the category whose object is R as an R module, and whose morphisms are the endomorphisms of R as an R module. The matrix category is the category whose objects are R modules with a finite basis, free R modules equipped with a finite basis, and the morphisms are matrices. And then you can Kurobe complete it. And what you end up with is you end up with the category whose objects are direct sumands of free modules equipped with a basis. That just comes from the construction. This is the smallest category, which contains R as an R module, contains direct sums, and contains splittings of idempotents. And a not very hard but non-trivial statement is that this category. Oh, I have one other piece of notation I'm trying to advocate. I tried to advocate this notation that we should write an arrow with a hook for split surjection. I want to advocate a notation that this this construction where you take a ring, one object, deloop it, take matrices, and Kurobe complete, that's some type of suspension construction. So I'm going to write it as sigma R. Anyway, the basic fact is that this category, the sigma R, is equivalent. I constructed it as the category of direct sumands of modules equipped with a basis, free module, direct sumands of free modules. But the statement is that it's actually So it's the smallest category that contains the free modules and contains direct summands. On the other hand, it turns out it's the largest category that contains the compact projective R modules. That's a full subcategory of R modules. This isn't that hard to prove. You need to know the fact that modules, that R modules have presentations, that they can be surjected by free modules. And then you have to unpack what these notions of compactness and projectivity are. Being a compact or a projective object is something just about an abelian category. And so I'm telling you not a fact about abelian categories, I'm telling you a fact about rings right now. That this construction produces this object which is just defined in terms of abelian categories. Even more importantly than that is that if R is commutative, then sigma R has yet another description. If R is commutative, then the category of R modules is symmetric monoidal, and sigma R is the full subcategory of fully dualizable R modules. I'll actually write that out of dualizable R modules. So I have three different, a priori different categories here. One was the smallest category built in some way. So it was inductive. I start with some very few objects and I expand it out. And the second one was the largest category that consisting of some objects defined in terms of the abelian category structure on modules. And the third has to do with the symmetric monoidal structure on R modules when R is commutative. And Chris wanted to interrupt me. I don't think I understand the question.
Maybe Eric can clarify that a little bit. And there's another question in the meantime. Is there a reason to prefer commutative over abelian?
So I think the second question was, is there a reason to prefer either this description of sigma R or this description of sigma R? And the answer is, I don't have a reason to prefer one or the other. If I care about non-commutative rings, which sometimes some people in the audience probably like the representation theory of non-commutative algebras, and then this is a very important description. But other people in the audience care about topological quantum field theory, in which case this is probably what they care the most about. I'm in a physics institute, and so I care about both, because both non-commutative algebra and TQFT are important in physics. And then the other question was something about the presentation. And the question might be, is it obvious why different, I've presented each object in here has a by construction has a presentation as a direct summand of a free module. But the same object, I mean, by the same, there's also lots of interesting morphisms in this category. And those morphisms might provide isomorphisms between objects that I've presented different ways. So there might be different objects that are the same up to isomorphism in that sense. I mean, I wrote equality, but that's very sloppy. These are equivalent, there's natural equivalences of categories between these three. I mean, these two categories are just both presented as subcategories of the category of modules. And so they might actually be equal if you're that type of person. The category that I've called sigma R is not. It's a category whose objects come with a presentation, but that presentation is not preserved by isomorphism. So that was the first, the first half of my talk, and I went 5 minutes slower than I meant, but I'm going to continue. Because now I'd like to update this for the 21st century. I'm also... I'm going to use a color because I like colors, except I'm told that none of you can see any colors, which means it might not actually matter. Oh well, maybe I won't. Oh. Those of you who can see that this is a different color, it'll be useful, and if you can't, I'm sorry. So as I said, now I want to tell you this in n categories. So now let's say C is now an n category. And by n category, I mean what might be called a weak n category, or what yesterday Noah was calling a discrete n category. I don't mean an infinity n category. I don't know how to do what I'm doing with infinity n categories. The definition that I would like to use for weak n category is inductive. A weak n category is an infinity 1 category enriched in the infinity 1 category of weak n minus 1 categories. And a weak 1 category is just an ordinary category. So, if C is an n category, then I'm going to call it not a split surjection, but I'll call a condensation. In C of x onto y, I'll still write it with this hooked arrow, is an object in the category x, an object in the category y, or sorry, an object x, an object y, a one morphism f, and a one morphism g. And rather than saying that the composition is equal to the identity on y, because you shouldn't talk about equality, I could say that maybe there's an isomorphism, but that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to say that the composition g and then f itself has a condensation onto the identity on y. And just so you don't worry that this is very circular definition, I want to notice that this is a condensation. This is going on in the n minus 1 category of endomorphisms on y. So that's the definition. When you unpack this definition, what you find out is that I'm telling you some cells that are filling in a ball. So if you try to unpack this, for instance, when n is 2, so for instance, I'm telling you that I have an object x, an object y, the morphisms g and f. Now you can look at the composition, do g and then f, and I'm telling you that there's a 2 morphism of that composition onto the identity, and a 2 morphism in the other way. And if I'm at a 2 category, then I'm telling you that if I go up and back down, that's the identity. So there's an equation filling in that 2 cell. If I'm in a 3 category, then I have 2 more 2 cells and an equation filling in the 3 cell, and so on. And I want to say, note that this is not a notion that maybe you've seen. So many of you in the audience have studied dualizability and have studied adjunctions. And I want to note that this is not an adjunction between f and g. Although it has roughly the same amount of data. So an adjunction also has some one morphisms and some two morphisms. And so it feels in about the same amount of data, but it's a different notion. It's very related to adjunctions. But it's not the same. So again, when you have a condensation, something you can do is you can study the composition in the other order, where you do g and then f. Sorry, do f and then g. That's an endomorphism of x. And it no longer satisfies that it's idempotent. It no longer squares to the identity. But its square, is do f and then g and then do f and then g. And this middle f and g can condense onto the identity. And so this square condenses. It's not equal to, but it condenses onto the identity, onto itself. And this condensation of e squared onto e satisfies an associativity property. If you look at e cubed, do I have space to write this? So if you look at e cubed, well, that's g f g f g f. And if I condense in either the first spot or the second spot, those don't matter. So both ways to condense down to E commute. So this map from E squared to E, you should think of that as this. Wait, what is a condensation of E squared onto E? It's two pieces of data. It's a morphism from E squared to E that you could think of as a multiplication map. And it's a morphism in the other direction that you could think of as a co-multiplication map. And so if you look at this square, this is, you could start at any side of the square, any corner of the square, and go either kind of say co-multiply and multiply or multiply and co-multiply. And I'm telling you that all of those commute when I tell you that the square of condensations commute. And when you unpack that, what you find out is that M is associative. And the co-multiplication is co-associative. And also a Frobenius property. And finally, by construction, co-multiplying and then multiplying was supposed to be the identity on E. So what I'm telling you is I'm telling you that this composition, this is some type of special Frobenius algebra. There's no reason. Yes. I can hear you. The question is, do they commute or do they commute up to higher morphism? In a two category, they just commute, if I'm in a two category. And kind of the way I've written this, I was sort of writing it as if I was in a two category. Of course, I mean they commute up to natural coherence in higher categories. In my whole talk, I'm going to suppress all of those coherence information. And I'm suppressing it for a very specific reason. What coherence information you have to include when you're working with n categories, that's a model-dependent question. You have to fix a model, and your model will say, oh, you need to use these coherences, but these other ones you don't need to use. I'm trying to work model independently, so I'm just not going to work with any of that coherence stuff. There's a risk of doing I'm not doing anything so complicated that you'll run into issues of whether the coherences are sufficiently coherent. But if you'd like, you can focus on the case of, say, a two category for this narrative. In higher categories, what I'm doing is you can work out sort of that, well, anyway, in a two category, the statement is that E is a special Frobenius algebra, and I want to say it has no reason to be. There's a special Frobenius algebra object in the monoidal category of endomorphisms of X. If this gets too small, somebody needs to tell me. And I want to say it has no reason to be. It has no reason to be unital. I mean, it might be unital, but it has no reason to be unital in the way I've told the story. And I won't get to go into it, but this issue of unitality of this algebra is intimately related to this issue of whether the morphisms are adjoints to each other. So when the morphisms are adjoints, then this is actually a unital algebra or co-unital, depending on which way the adjunction goes. So the basic theorem is the same. The basic theorem is that X, together with the special Frobenius algebra, determines the rest of the splitting uniquely. Now, the way I've said it, you might think that's only a theorem in two categories, in which case it's a theorem of Douglas and Reuter. But what I really mean to say is the following. So you could take my original description of a condensation. A condensation was some diagram in C of some shape. So there is a universal condensation, a sort of walking condensation, which is the universal n category of this shape. And if you take that universal n category, you can look at the subcategory supported at x. And so if you think about kind of there's some notion, say a condensation monad. In an N category, is a thing which with an X and an endomorphism satisfying all properties, all equations that would happen, all data, you know, with all higher morphisms, I should say, all higher data. That would be true if this endomorphism arose from a condensation. And you can make sense of that in terms of these like walking categories, walking objects. And then what I'm telling you, even in an N category, is that X together with a condensation monad determines the splitting uniquely if it exists. And here uniquely means that you can study the N category of ways that it factors. That N category is either contractible or empty. And the proof is a very inductive proof. So let me give an example. Is that I might have an n dimension. Oh, this n was a different n. Oh well. Suppose X is an n dimensional, n space time dimensional TQFT. Maybe I don't want to say TQFT too precisely. Let's say some sort of topological quantum system. I really want to talk about this in terms of topological phases of condensed matter. Topological gapped quantum system. I said that I used the word condensation in my title. So there's we don't have a definition of gapped topological phase of matter. But if there were such a definition, if this were a notion that actually had been fully axiomatized in mathematical physics, then it would certainly be true that n-dimensional gapped phases, gapped systems, form an n category. Again, this is the space-time dimension, n minus 1 plus 1. These would certainly form a category where the morphisms are interfaces between systems, codimension 1 interfaces. That would be the 1 morphisms. And the 2 morphisms would be interfaces between interfaces. So if I have such a system, then and it might have a finite group of flavor symmetries. Then something I can do is I can gauge that symmetry. I can take my system X on one side. And I'll build a morphism between X and the theory, which is X gauged by G. The data of X gauged by G, an object, you know, the field theory X has some fields, it has some excitations. An excitation in X gauged by G is, well, there's an excitation, so the local excitations here, the fields here are, well, there's some X fields and there's some G gauge fields and they're coupled in some way. The coupling comes from the way that the G symmetry acts on X. And you can build a defect between them, where you can build a defect which is an interface which is transparent to the X fields. But the G fields have Dirichlet boundary condition. Yes. The question is, what do I mean by a flavor symmetry? A flavor symmetry is just a way of saying a global symmetry of the theory. I mean that as opposed to I don't know, it's an old-fashioned language. In the standard model, there's a flavor, rough flavor symmetry relating the three flavors of lepton. And then there's also a kind of local gauge redundancy that's sometimes called a gauge symmetry or a color symmetry, relating the different colors of quark. What are called color symmetries have already been gauged and are not actually symmetries of anything. They're redundancies in your field description of the theory. Whereas flavor symmetries just means global symmetry. It means that it is actually a symmetry of your field theory. Yes? So what's missing that would make it into an adjunction? I won't be able to remember what reflective and co-reflective localizations are while I'm like standing by the board, so I won't answer that question, but we can discuss afterwards. What's missing is, first of all, my definition in an N category was kind of had all the way up to category level N data. But even in a two category, so in a two category, I'm telling you two morphisms and two cells that both go between the identity on Y and the composition FG. To have an adjunction between F and G, you would also need this would require also a two cell kind of between the other composition and the identity on X. And which direction that two cell went depended on which direction of adjunction you'd have. And then there would have to be some equation relating this two cell to some other two cell to have an adjunction. So this is the, having an adjunction, once you have an adjunction, often it's pretty unique. So this two cell is pretty close to being property. And in the paper, we do have a result. So if the category C, if C is an at least two category with the property that every morphism has a right adjoint, then you can always assume that G is the right adjoint to F, which is to say, given any condensation, you can replace it by an equivalent condensation for which there's an adjunction. So there's a kind of a procedure that always enhances things to being adjunctions. But I haven't told you what equivalences of condensations are. And do I have 5 or 10 minutes left? When did I start? OK, I have 10 minutes left, Chris says. Which is great, that's the time I do. So what I was saying is that you can build an interface between X and the theory gauged by X. And you can also build an interface in the other direction, back to X, in the same way. And you can make one of these the interface F and the other the interface G. And now I'm going to worry I got my order wrong. Well, whatever. I forget which way. Maybe my morphisms go from right to left, which means that this is the morphism F and this is the morphism G. And if you, so then I want to think of it in the other direction. So I want to do, if I want to do G and then F, then I can imagine, I said it all wrong. Well, anyway, I'll let you work it out. The property I want to say, yeah, so if you do in this order, if you do G and then F, then you get an interface from G to itself, which from X gauge by G to itself, which supports some excitations that can then be further gauged away, because you can kind of close it up. So all I want to say is that that in general, kind of, there's a way that X will condense onto the gauged theory by G. Let me say this more generally without talking about the specific example of gauging a symmetry group. So this notion of gapped condensation that I'm talking about, let me say this a little bit more generally. What does it mean to condense in condensed matter? What it means to condense is you start with some system in some phase of matter. You might bring down from it, you might sort of add in some extra fields that are in the trivial phase. That doesn't change the phase of matter that you start with. Now that you've added in those extra fields with the trivial phase, you might modify the Hamiltonian for your system that might condense some particles out, that might condense something. So you do this in a lab, you might do this in a chemistry lab. You could start with some system of potassium chloride in some trivial liquid phase because it's dissolved. You might add in some other trivial liquid phase of some other salt, and then you might kind of modify the Hamiltonian maybe by changing the temperature a little bit that would make something precipitate, something might condense out of it. So if your phases of matter are gapped, you could start with some kind of original phase X, and you might have some new phase that you, new system produced from condensation by kind of physical condensation. And it might have the property that they might both be in the top, they might both be topological. And if you have that system, well, something you're allowed to do in a laboratory is you're allowed to do what I did with the gauge theory. You're allowed to arrange your laboratory where you have the X system way over here. Maybe the camera's going to track me, maybe not. And you have the Y system way over here. And adiabatically in space, you slowly turn on or off this condensation procedure. Now, if they're in the gapped phase, then instead of a gradual transition from X to Y, if they're both in the gap topological phases of matter, you could zoom way out and get a wall between them, which is to say a defect. Typically, this wall will support non-gapped excitations, but this wall might be gapped. And when it is, you get basically you can then proceed the way I've said, and build condensation in my sense of X onto Y. So it might be gapped, which is to say it might be a one morphism in the category of gapped quantum systems. OK, so I have like 5 minutes. I'm going to rush through the last results, which are to say that that just as in the one category sense, I told you already I lost my red chalk, but you guys probably couldn't see red chalk anyway. No, I found it again. So I told you already that condensation monad, one of these basically what's basically a Frobenius algebra, determines its splitting if it exists. And now you could ask, can you build, given an N category, can you build an N category that in which all condensations actually condense, in which all condensation monads condense? And the answer is yes. Let me assume, given some n category C, which is with all HOM n minus 1 categories to be condensation complete, meaning I'm going to assume that in every HOM n minus 1 category, any diagram like that, or any condensation monad extends to a diagram. So these are always non-empty. Then I can build a Karibi completion, a condensation completion, where the objects are the condensation monads in C, which is, again, to say it's an object is an object X, an endomorphism E, and then some data on E. And then the morphisms from X with E to X prime with E prime, are very similar. It's a morphism from X to X prime. And no, the only change is that rather than saying that M is equal to ME, I say that there's a condensation of ME onto M, and also a condensation in this direction, and some associativity. and Frobenius properties. I won't write them out, but they are explicit. There's some finite, somewhat complicated diagram that exactly presents these. If the defect is gapped, why are they considered different phases? The usual definition of, well, there's no real definitions. The usual idea of gapped phase of matter is that a gapped phase of matter is one where the two systems are in the same gapped phase if you can continuously deform between them without the low-lying spectrum particularly changing. In particular, no eigenvalues are allowed to either enter or leave the ground state. No ground states are allowed to either enter or leave the very bottom of the spectrum. When I said that the cis phase was gapped, I'm not saying that. So what can happen here is sort of how some ground states might enter or exit. The low spectrum of this phase might change as you deform from x to y. If you spread that deformation out adiabatically in space, it's hard to see what's happening. But if you zoom very far away, what you see is just the system X, the system Y, and an interface between them, which is supporting its own quantum field theory, its own quantum system. And you are allowed to ask, what is that? What is the spectrum of that system? Another way to say that is I could take this whole configuration and ask somehow, what's the spectrum of this kind of system with a defect, and ask, does that system have a gapped spectrum or not? I don't know if that answered the question. Yeah. The question is if I have two phases separated by a gap defect, does that mean that there's a condensation in my sense between them? And the answer, I believe, is no. So being able to condense from one, so the issue is the following. Because my definition is inductive, I kind of didn't give enough details on this board. Because my definition is inductive, there's like what it really means to say that I condense from x to y is I should then be able to put, you know, what I could do is I could adiabatically kind of start at x and go to y, but I could also adiabatically go in the other direction. Condensation procedures in the physical laboratory might be very anisotropic. There's no reason for condensed matter systems to have any like rotation invariance. So these two interfaces might look very different. But I could still build them, and I could ask that they're both gapped. It's not just that one of them's gapped. What I really want is that no matter what direction I turn on or off the condensation procedure, it should be gapped. Now, when I look at this combined system and compose them, I start at y, I see a thin slab of x, and go back to y. And again, I can kind of adiabatically turn that condensation off in either direction. And because I can keep doing this in every direction until I end up with a system which is just the phase y with a little bubble of x, those were all gapped procedures by requirement. And then that last bubble can be removed to get a condensation. So that's my definition of gapped condensation. OK. I have 0 minutes left. So I'm going to very quickly just sort of say the last statements. And I have almost no writing to do. So this is now a theorem of mine and Davide Gaiota. So that's the wrong order. Alphabetical is, yeah. The condensation completion is an N category. That's highly non-obvious the way I told you. You have to be able to compose bimodules. It contains C fully faithfully all condensation monads condense. It's universal for those properties. It contains all absolute limits, and in the vect-enriched world, I need to include direct sums. And I told you that there was one part of my story where it really, like, a little bit more work from the technicians in higher categories should happen. So I'm absolutely sure that this is true. And in the paper, we give our exact axioms of what we require from some model of n categories with respect to limits. But to my knowledge, there's not yet enough that's been done about kind of the general theory of limits and colimits in enriched infinity categories to really do this precisely yet. But once that's been done, I'm sure our proof just will go through. And then the last example I want to say is the same thing. I could start with R not a ring, but say a monoidal category. Actually, let me just do the most important, the commutative part. So I could start with, so this is going to be this kind of, the compact projective stuff's interesting, but for TQFTs, I really care about this dualizability issue. So rather than R being a commutative ring, we could take R to be, say, a symmetric monoidal N category. And again, I can make its one-point delooping. I can take direct sums if I need to, which I actually don't. And I can Karubi complete if I want. And this is what I'll again call the suspension of R. So notice that this is now an n plus 1 category. And our statement, our theorem is, and I want to say that let's say R, I'm going to assume that all HOM n minus 1 categories. No, I'm going to assume that R is Karubi complete itself. All condensations should exist in R. Then our theorem is that the suspension of R is equivalent to the full subcategory. So the full subcategory, kind of the modules for R on the fully dualizable ones. Not fully dualizable, the one dualizable modules. R modules, where these are I have no extra completeness beyond Karubi completeness. So it's important for what I'm saying that I'm working in a very just the Karubi complete world. I'm not completing for any other colimits. I'm not doing kind of I'm not working in the Rex world, for instance, or the presentable world for what I'm saying. So these are like just R module n categories. So all maybe linear categories and linear functors, no right exactness or anything. And then the remarkable statement that I want to say is that although the suspension is just the one dualizables, if R itself, so R itself was a symmetric monoidal N category, it might itself have all duals. I mean, it might be a rigid monoidal category. Then actually sigma R has all duals, which is to say it's the fully dualizable R modules. So this is a world where as soon as you're one dualizable, you're automatically fully dualizable. And the when R was just like the category of vector spaces, then this was a statement of Ulrika-Tillemans. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Part of that question by Ezra Getzler.
In other words, is there any chance of identifying a minimal model for the universal additive function?
Okay, I'm going to mute you again. I think this is a great question. It's not one I've thought about particularly. So the question was basically kind of to what extent could this work? I mean, a version of the question is sort of, I said this in terms of just kind of discrete N categories. And you, I think this question is probing to what extent can this be used to give a presentation of idempotent completion in infinity N categories. I don't know the answer, but I will say one thing. You know, I'm on camera, so I don't want to make too many conjectures that I'm not confident about. But if I had to put money on it, I would say that yes, this notion that I've written down is a sort of causal notion for these kind of condensation monads. So a statement that I know how to prove and that I don't know a reference for is that if I were just in the one category, like if I were just at n equal for two categories, if I were really just working with special Frobenius algebra objects, the notion of being to be a special Frobenius algebra, being a special Frobenius algebra can be presented. There's no operad that presents special Frobenius algebras because Frobenius algebras include a comultiplication, but there is a what's called a properad that presents special Frobenius algebras. And that properad is quadratic and Kozul. It's as good as a properad can be from the perspective of Kozul duality. So that gives me confidence to think that this notion would have good Kozulity properties. But that's all I can say about that question. Pleasure. Thank you.